Well, it was really interesting, Sharon, was that word bid-ben, bid-bont coming up for you? Because, of course, that phrase is a crucial phrase from the Mabinogion. It's also crucial in terms of the poem we've been, Prithayanun. Because although it's, you're right, its basic meaning is who would be a leader must be a bridge. The word pen or ben is the same word that we use for pen anuven. And pen means, it does mean leader or chieftain, but it also means a generative source. It means that the source of life. And what it's talking about, that phrase, is that if you would be the align or be one at one with the source of life, you automatically are in the position of bridging that life. Because that life, that originative life moves, continually overflows. So you are continually in the position of being a bridge. Now the phrase comes from the story of Bendigeidfran, which means Bran the Blessed, who lays his body, who in a great war between the Welsh and the Irish in order to rescue his sister, lays his body down so that the troops can pass over it. So he has to literally bridge between the two realities so that actually a battle can happen. So, and in the course of this battle, there is total destruction of both Ireland and of Britain. And everything is stripped down to its barest components. So you have in Ireland, you have a number of pregnant women sitting in a cave. In Wales, there are a very few of the people left who gather in the hall of Bran. Bran himself dies, but has his head cut off, so that he has head meaning, of course, pen. So you have the feast of the noble, in Britain you have the feast of the noble head, which is a gathering of beings around the center of life. And for the Celts, one of the things about the when people want to do Celtic reconstruction, the thing they never really look at is the fact that many of the Celtic tribes were headhunters. So they one of the great Celtic customs is to go to war against your competitors, and you really hope to come back with a few heads that you can stick in your local shrine to increase the kind of power, because they saw the head as being the source of generation, source of life, source of creativity. So what that phrase talks about is, in a way, the heart of what we're doing. It's about, because the story starts with something having gone wrong, a breakdown in communication, things not working. The Bran is separated from Branwen, his female side. Branwen is his sister who is in Ireland, and who is treated very badly there. So there is a split, a break in the world that has to be addressed, and has to be addressed with will and energy, and a war has to happen, and something has to die, and then something, and has to be stripped back right to the beginning of things, so that something new can arise. And in a way, when we look at the poem Prithayanun, we travel with Arthur in order to find the cauldron and the sword of light, in order to find the elements of creation. And we have all kinds of obstacles in that process, as we know. We looked at it in lots of detail. Lots of things go wrong, and we have this constant refrain, but for seven, none come, none return from Caer Suddhi, Caer Fandwi, whichever Caer. Right? So there is a constant stripping away to the essentials. But the place the poem ends up in is this idea of the chief is born, and this dialogue between those who know and those who don't know. And those who know the mystery are those who can descend into the depths, can connect to the place of origin, and can then bridge between that place of origin and the outside world. And it's easy to talk about bridging as an idea or as a story, but the actual experience of bridging is to be the connecting point between incompatible things. You know, if you're holding hands with people who like each other, that's a nice experience, yes? If you're holding hands with two people who hate each other and hate you for holding their hands, you're trying to pull two people together. It's a bit like, you know, poles of a magnet. You try and push them together. It's a place of great tension, a place of possibility, because in the friction, in the difficult field that gets generated out of that, fundamental things can shift.
Can you just say that last sentence?
Yeah. In that field of antagonism, that field of difficulty, that field, that it's a very energized field. And so if you can stay with that, then that potency can shift fundamental things. And the point of working with opposites in whatever way that we do is that we have to stay with it and stay in that place of real difficulty and not knowing why the bloody hell you're there and feeling all the different incompatible feelings until mysteriously something shifts from underneath, normally from underneath or for some little... Most of these deep shifts happen apparently by accident. You notice something or something shifts inside you and the whole paradigm flips over. And you can't control it and you can't command it. All you can do is do your best to stay with the process.
I think there's a mirror image here of actually being the witness to that happening. You know, if you're not the one that's suffering, as it were, but you're with the one that's suffering, and that could be in a group or one-to-one or whatever. That which you said is also true.
Yeah, I think that's true, yeah. And of course, it's very hard to be with. And I think there's something about the thing that you discovered about the thing that helps us be there is the constancy of love. Mm. This idea that underneath there is a quality of love that is constant and never goes away. Because actually one of the really difficult things is how can we stay here? How do we do that? You know, it's sort of mad. Why would we stay there? And actually the reason that we stay there is something to do with the nature of love. And often we talk, it's not like we feel loving in that place. It's like, it's the place in us that doesn't give up, even though we want to give up. Right, so there's something that keeps us there, and that keeps us concerned or present enough or interested enough to try and stay there. And when that happens, and that synergy happens, something else emerges, something new, something different, maybe a little different, but still different. In a way, I suppose that's, you know, what we've been looking at this weekend, and really unexpectedly, I had no idea we were going to look at Sulis Minerva and Temple of Bath, you know, but actually, as we sit here at the end of the weekend, I just think, that was really right, really, because the whole point of the Temple of Sulis Minerva is it's about opposites. It's about Rome and Celtic traditions. It's about Minerva and Sulis. It's sort of there's no purity in anything here. It's all opposites together. If you go there today, you deal with the opposite of this ancient holy place, which has got this enormous bloody abbey on top of it, and people selling the waters in lots of ways in the spa. And so that's another set of opposites you have to contend with. you know, instead of being, and as you pointed out, Annie, instead of being able to go to the bath, it used to be great when they were just left alone. Now it's a big production because it's part of the bath tourist industry. You know, so that's another set of opposites. You say, so there's something about this whole kind of, and there's something in particular, I think, about this image of the kind of Rome and Celtic traditions that's really strong, because the thing about it is this idea of the flowing line and the organic image, as opposed to the geometric and linear image. Right, so the these two very different ways of relating to the world. Now, if we go back into the, you know, we don't have any. If you look at, you know, Greek and Roman tradition in particular, you have all kinds of images of gods. They get very, the gods' images get very reified, very concrete. Celtic images are absolutely the opposite. They're these suggestive kind of lines. They're shape-shifting figures. They don't. They're sort of, you know, archaeologists have more or less worked out what some of them mean, but a lot of them they've no idea. And the difference, the different. You engage with a concrete image of a, so you like it or you won't like it. But you haven't got a lot of space to put yourself into it, unless you maybe really like it if it touches you. But even so, there's a limit to it. If you look at some of the more flowing kind of Celtic images, actually there is much more possibility in that. And in a way, those images come from a much more inward place. Ultimately, when we go in and in and in, what we find is just nothing. We find that we go the place over the hill where there is just stillness, nothingness. But that nothingness is like the womb space. That's the place where things emerge from. Now it has therefore to have no form, because if it has form in that place, then it limits the forms that can arise out of it. So the deepest place, the very center of our experience, is empty. But that's the place from which everything is kind of generated.
Full of potential.
Full of total potential, so therefore it can't have any form attached to it. Because all form, so form is necessary in order to come out and relate and touch each other and work with each other. Form has to be created. But form limits potential, collapses potential. It's like the quantum thing. To become the particle, the quantum wave has to die. It dies into the form until it collapses back again into the wave state. Yeah. In order for the quantum wave to become the particle, it has to die. The quantum wave state doesn't exist. It then becomes particle, and the wave state doesn't re-emerge until the particle dies, and it then is expressed as a potential, as a wave of probability.
I just had to learn something last weekend, if I can say it, which is something about. You coalesce into density, into form,
yep.
To get the strength to have a muscle or something.
Yeah.
And then that has to give way into a more, what's the word, movement.
Yeah.
I can't remember the word for it. But it breaks down into being able to coalesce into something else that
yep.
moves you on to something else. So there's this constant, the thing
yielding.
Is not...
Yielding, is it?
Yielding is one of those words, but so there's this constant, so it's not very practically, it's not good to sit or to stand or have routines in your life too heavy because you densify.
Yes, you do.
So
you
try to keep flexible all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So it promotes the fluidity in the body, right? So that, because actually, yes, if we move in just stereotypical way, so this is as straightforward as how we move ourselves. If we just move in particular ways, we build up particular stress patterns in our muscles. We also build up neurological connections that about how we can move and how we should move.
And then my brain does it about other things.
Yes. That's right. So we build up a sort of... I always remember, I did a lot of work once with really old people, and a slight exaggeration perhaps, but they really did seem to fall into two types. There were people who were really old and incredibly rigid, really rigid, really angry all the time, and sort of, and then there were these really young old people who were really fluid and very alive, and you forgot that they were old because they were just so alive and fluid and sort of, and it's almost like actually there's a choice, these are choice points somewhere about if we keep alive and keep open, but if we're going to do that, we also have to keep letting things go, we have to keep experimenting, we have to keep dissolving our forms and returning to the point of origin inside us. And the constancy of love is really important in this, because actually it's bloody difficult to let go of things. There's no more common word used around spiritual things. Oh, just let go, just let go. Fucking difficult. It's scary, and nobody really likes to do that because you don't know what's coming next. And so there's something important about the sense of, well, actually underneath everything, there is the possibility of love. So why would we do anything? In the end, we do it for love. Not sentimental love. We do it because of that presence of connection. That terrifying presence of connection. It sounds like, the presence of love sounds like that would be easy to open to. Okay? Absolutely terrifying to be loved and to love in return, because that really is the really big surrender, the big giving away, the big dependence, to open yourself to the presence of love, the divine, whatever the hell we mean by that. Now, very occasionally we can perhaps touch that in its pure form in a moment, so that the formless love. More often than not, we touch it in other people, we touch it in sense of inner beings or things that we love. And the confusion that we can get into is that we can attach the love to the form rather than seeing the form is the icon through which the love shines. In some ways, all our work really is about how to let idols turn into icons, how to stop icons turning into idols. The whole thing about an icon is it is an image that shows the light. It's transparent. It has form, but it needs to have form because we need to relate through form, but it shows the potential of the uncreated light that's underneath the form. An idol, on the other hand, is like a bundle of belief and density that says I am the only truth. So the places where inside us as we feel unlovable, often where a lot of our idols live, let's say it is an absolute truth that I can only be loved as long as I'm giving very good attention to people and I'm never angry with them. Okay, that can be an internal idol, one of mine, in fact. Right, so that's there's no transparency there. There's no other possibility there. It's solid. And in a way, the work is really to convert the idols into icons. And to allow the icons which emerge within us to transmit the light and then to die when their time is done. Every image about ourselves and the world that we created starts off as an icon, right? It starts off as a direct expression of light and life. Even our deep angers, our deep depressions, they're ways of they have appropriate present images that helps hold the light in the moment when they are generated. you know, sometimes very angry, very depressed forms, are there to protect, right? So the place where you vanish into depression, where you can't feel anything, in the moment when that's first generated, out of the conditions that you find yourself in, this is a shape that holds the light. It's an icon that expresses the best possibility that's available in that moment. And if it could just die and we could just come back to the resting state and be with the mysterious aspect of the body and the heart, then that would be fine. We could just keep going back to the zero place and letting the new things emerge. But of course, that isn't what happens. We shape our experience in relationship to the past.
Yeah, and if you'd say, we'll just let go at that point, it doesn't feel right.
No, we can't do it. I mean, it's impossible. It's actually impossible to do, because by the point that this has just generated, it's got its own life. It's an independent life form. Mm. Right, the idol has its own life. You can't just say, oh, well, let's, you know, because, what we have to learn to do is to talk to the idol, to penetrate. In a way, we have to penetrate its density to find the spark of light within it that is connected to the mysterious light that is of the nature of love. And when that can be found, and when the poor old idol can be received with love, it can let itself go, it can let go. The idol, in a way, is doing its best to protect us from the conditions that formed it. It just doesn't know that those conditions no longer apply. So it needs clarity and kindness.
It's got a life of its own, so it doesn't want to die.
So it needs a real lot of help in order to come to the place where it can let itself die, because it needs to know that it's going to die into love, not into harshness. Because mostly when people talk about letting things go, they're talking about a kind of harsh kind of energy of you know, just pay attention, let it go. You know, you can feel, almost hear it in the voice. It's a sort of sharp, move on, get over it. You know, it's a sort of... it's telling it off, and it's getting, and all it does is repress, right? So when people talk about that, it just represses it, so you don't know where you think you've moved on. Hell, have you moved on? You've just pushed it out of awareness, and so like all things that are repressed, it'll come out in your body, it'll come out in other parts of your life in a different form. But it'll be the same old idol. It's sort of still trying to do its job of keeping you safe. The really challenging thing, though, of sort of living like this is to really trust that deep place inside. Because you do, and to try and tolerate the feeling of being out of control. Because if you are going to live from there, the kind of more conscious part of you is a lot of the time going to be freaked out because you don't know why the hell you're doing things or saying things. You know, it can happen in small ways, like defending a weekend where I think, why the hell am I saying this? Oh God, I hope we'll come. And and for me, it's one of those moments when I'm doing meditation, so I literally don't know what's coming. You know, every time I do a meditation, I really honestly don't know what's coming next. And there are these moments where things just stop. And I'm all right, because I'm used to things stop. But then it starts to go on a bit long, and then a little bit of me starts to panic. Of course, because maybe this is the moment when it's all going to go wrong. And that's one of my idols somewhere, that is the sense of, you know, so that the places where I don't trust the deeper lights, where I don't, you know, because even, in a way, even if it did just stop, and even if we had to be within ourselves, we saw, nothing's coming now, that would be all right. Right. But there's something about that in me that would be horrified. I couldn't possibly let that happen. Oh my God. I just feel the contraction in my body when I say it. If I just dried up in the middle of a meditation and couldn't say anything else, if I just dried up and lost it, okay? I might have to, and it might be great that I did that. I mean, I'll tell you a really good example of that happened to me once, that when I was working in Israel, I was doing this powerful piece of work with this pilot. Who'd been in the Israeli Air Force and had therefore killed a lot of people. and who was consumed with guilt about it, and was, and you know, brave man really to come to a group and really, and particularly brave in very early societies where the pilots are heroes, they're real heroes, and they're regarded as the people who've saved Israel. So for a pilot to sit in front of a bunch of other Israelis and me, and to say how ashamed and how guilty he is, and how terrible that he's killed people, and it was a very gutsy thing. So I was doing this really powerful bit of body work, and he was struggling, or really stuck, and he was absolutely stuck. And I'm really aware I'm desperate to go to the loo. I'm absolutely desperate. And I'm quite good at work, particularly I'm working in a situation like that in front of a group. I'm really good at holding stuff and holding my own stuff, and so I'm thinking, that's all right, I can be with this. I've done it a lot of times, I'll just rush out at the end and I'll just do it. And then, but of course he's almost stuck, I was stood there. And there comes a moment where I think, I'm just going to have to go to the loo. I can't, otherwise I'm going to sit here. It really came to a place, I can either go to the loo or I can sit here and pee myself in front of the group. Right. So it really, it honestly did come to that point, because I'm bloody stubborn and I'm really resistant when I'm up against stuff, so that I can really stretch it out. But I really did come to that point where I thought, well, I can't, no, that's worse. I can't just pee, you know, because I knew it, there'd be a lot. So I said, I'm really, really, really sorry. I've just got to go to the loo. I'll be back. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I've abandoned, you know, all the things, I've abandoned him. He was right in this terrible place. And I'm, you know, and I'm peeing as quickly as I can, but it's taking a long time because I've been sitting with it a long time, and there's a lot of it. And I'm thinking, oh, God's sake. And you can't make yourself pee. There's a limit to how much you can make yourself pee. You know, you can do your best, you put the pressure on, but no, it doesn't keep up. So it goes on, it goes on, it goes on. Anyway, and eventually, I sort of nice little scurry back in. Feeling physically better, feeling terrible on every other level. And you just imagine the worst possible bloody thing. And I was expecting that he'll be in some terrible state. And actually what happened, it was brilliant. I was stunned. Well, because the group had held him. And they'd been talking in Hebrew. And of course, we'd been working in English and Hebrew and trying our best. And they'd been talking in Hebrew together and sort of... And he had come through something. And actually, it was really necessary I got out of the way. Because I was mediating, I was between him and the group in a sense, and then something, I don't quite to this day know what happened, because it was in Hebrew, and but actually that man was much more accepting and of his situation somewhere, and kind of, and somehow had come into himself, and it was really necessary that I get out of his way, but so difficult for me to do that. And in a way, I think that's, you know, that's just an example of my life, but that's the problem with these places. Right, so why couldn't I? It's ridiculous at one level. I could have, you know, I could have paused it at a much earlier point and done that. But actually, the problem with these idols that live aside is that there is no space in them. The feelings are absolute. So that absolute sense of badness, if I just looked after myself and not looked after him, it was just so strong. And I suppose that's why these places, and that's why it's not enough to say just let go. These things are very, very strong, and you know with your mind, you know bloody well, you know my mind. I knew I could have left him, but there was no, you know, I'd had to go to a real extreme before that part in me could let go, and it only let go because it would be more shameful to pee myself in front of people than anyway. You know, that was actually why I could let go. That was because that would have been something that was worse. So it wasn't a great enlightened, okay, I let him go. It's just I don't want to pee myself in front of anything that won't be good for me or for you, you know. So and in a way, that sort of stuff like that speaks the real of things like that phrase, let go. It's because what happened to me in the aftermath of that, of course, was powerful. Right, the fact that I didn't cause that by looking after myself, I didn't cause a disaster, and things were fine. That so somewhere you touch the presence of love, so we were all looked after in that. Yeah. The group were fine, he was fine. I have this revelation of actually that I can let go a little bit. You know, so there was love. You know, and it's love that does the healing in it. It's because in the shift. When you discover in the shift that things are okay, that you do the terrible thing or you do the taboo thing and you are looked after somewhere. It changes everything.
It
does, that's right, totally. And every little bit, and it happens in little bits, because you know, these are big things, you can't shift them overnight, but every time you touch that, it increases that degree of confidence and, you know, in the deeper process. And in a way, that's the key thing, isn't it? So it's the deeper process, and to touch that deep place in the heart, and to trust then the forms that arise out of that. And in a way, if you like the stories, the methods, the meditations we use here, they're just useful tools for, you know, that to some extent artificial, because we're, you know, because of the conditions under which we meet. You know, it's a sort of pressure cooker. We focus intensely on the work a couple of days at a time. But that process of creation is going on all the time. It's like all the time we're mediating, all the time we're bridging between the inside and the outside, between the past and the future, between the things we like and the things that we don't like. You know, so that art of bridging is a continual kind of process. And the more we can lean into that kind of deeper place, the more we can cooperate with that kind of flow in and out.
Oh, well, what? They do meet in the heart, don't they?
Yeah.
I'm still in the circulation in round, yeah, which was bigger of eight, but I mean, that is exactly how the heart works. It has four chambers. That is the centre point, so it goes through the mental step and through the gut step, and but it actually, that is the centre point,
yeah,
is the heart that. And so it's not that or that, it's the whole stretch of it.
Yeah. Circulates. That's right.
Like that, which is six and another.
So yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely it, right? So it is that. That's right, because then as you relate into that, you relate into that wider kind of structure. And it means that you relate ultimately then to the whole universe, right? So when we talk about the heart, we talk about that point of contact that is connected to everything else. So we are, in a sense, you could say, we are the living images of the uncreate light that's connected to everything. So we are the particular expressions, we are the particular particle expressions of that universal standing wave that's sort of underneath everything. And actually what happens, if we really pay close attention, we're all the time moving between wave state and particle state. So dying and coming back to life, dying, coming back to life. We notice it normally in the very big moments when very big shifts happen. But actually it happens every second, this kind of appearing, disappearing, flicker. It's everything's a flickering kind of motion. And the more we can get used to that, and the more we can cooperate with that, then letting go isn't something you do, it's something that happens. When we talk about, I must let that go, that's an impossible construction. I, solid object, I, must, never a good word, an external force acting on, let that go, other solid object. Right? It's an impossible construction. So we've turned ourselves into an object, we've turned whatever it is that we think is wrong into another object, and there's an external compulsion. There's nothing internal in that process, nothing that connects or makes possible the presence of love within it. Mm. It is only love that enables things to shift.
The meditation thing in Chan's was let in, let me, let go. And he gave a great talk. So you let it in, you notice what it is, and you get interested in it. And it's the getting interested and allowing it to be being with it that allows it to go in its own way. You can't let it go.
It's, yeah, that's
the
right.
Acceptance of it that lets it go.
And more than that, though, more than that, it's the, you have to, it's not just the acceptance of it, it's the acceptance of yourself in it.
Yeah.
Right, the problem with, I have real problems with the phrase letting go, if I'm honest, because it assumes something that is grabbing hold of things, that has to drop them off. Whereas actually the gestalt, it's about our identity. These things are not, they're not baggage that we've collected. Right, they're actual intimate parts of ourselves, and they're really parts that just need to return into the heart. We've done this, so their energy is recycled and can come back. They come back in forms, that now work. The whole letting go paradigm, I think, is a really flawed idea.
It's me who's misphrasing what Eddie was saying. He's saying the same thing as you. Forget letting go.
Yeah.
Let in and work with what letting be is, which is the same as you.
Yeah.
Well, that's what a heart does. I mean, I tend to think of things rather mechanically, that I'm actually thinking of a heart as in beating. That's what it does. The muscles contract. It pushes out, but it's not gone for good, because it will be round again.
It comes round again. Totally.
That's what it does. That's what makes a space for new things to come in. Is the pushing out.
Yeah.
Pushing out and it comes in, but it's not. Yeah, it's not gone for good. It will go round through the brain, or go round through the gut, come back.
Yeah.
Into the heart. It's sort of so. But that's what it is.
That's
what it does. That's when it's alive. If when it stops doing that, it's not.
It's not coming from a place of will. No, it just comes from a natural, it is a natural being alive and a vertebrate, or no, it doesn't have to be a vertebrate, it has to be bigger than a leg or something. No, it's a natural accompaniment to being alive.
I find it easier to think of it in an object. So if you thought of all the pets you've had, or your cat, it's like that you're gonna, or you hope you're gonna outlive your pet. So there's that whole relationship. And normally you love them a bit more when they get older.
So yeah, you do.
Go through that, so the sort of heart is a little bit more open when. As they get older and you're used to their character and blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. And then you're completely changed at the end of that experience. But your head could go, well, my cat's old and one day he's going to die. And this is going to happen and that's going to happen and I feel like this and I'll get over it. But it's never like that in your heart.
No, never like that. No, so it's a much more personal, much more mysterious. Because actually in your heart you don't want your cat to die.
Yeah.
Well, you want your cat to be an immortal. You'd like your cat to be an immortal cat, So that's just part of it. That's part of the, and in a way, it's part of love in that sense, because the problem with an idea that says we have to let things go and not get attached to things, it's like, then we shouldn't love things, I suppose, should we not? And that's sometimes what people do with that idea: don't get attached. They stop loving, because. It's a bit, yes, it's used a lot sometimes, and I think in an unfortunate way, because actually it is our nature to love and be loved, and therefore it is our nature to grieve and be sad, and that's, none of that is wrong. We need help from each other when we're really sad and really hurting, and God, do we want it? No, we don't want it, but actually it happens. It's as the inner teacher thing, it is as it is, it's...
Jack's ashes and the incense bowl reminded me of... I kind of miss him in a sort of, but it helped me connect with him as well. And then they're being thrown away, just like sweeping it away.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's horrible, and it's all right. And therefore, it's appropriate to feel upset about that, and not to feel I'm being silly, or it's a normal. It's horrible. I didn't want that to happen. And
that was as important to me as a picture on the wall.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, devil, of course. Yeah.
Remembering a time when I'm sitting with a client and there's something that walks into my head and goes, I really want to be sad. Okay.
No, I really do. And I'm going, no, I don't want to. And then I have to sort of go, breathe, just put that in your heart, Andy. And go, hi, lovely to see you. And sometimes it'll melt, or it'll find another route. Just go, hi, I'm back. And that's interesting to discern which is appropriate to be said or not.
It's tricky, isn't it? Yeah. And I think, but I think you're right. It is about placing your attention in the heart, and you do the best you can then. You see what, you know, try and trust what happens. That's.
Does that make sense?
Mm. And in a way, that therefore to trust the mischievous connections that happen. Because when we do start living like that, you know, we get up from a meditation this morning and a talk this morning, and outside is a van with a hare and an owl on it. And, you know, and that's powerful. That's, you know, we've been with hares and owls all weekend, and suddenly, okay, there's a hare and an owl. I don't know what it means, but what those things do is they stop the world for a moment. They bring in the reality of the inner world. It's not just inner, it's around us, it is tangible. And that's one of the very freaky things. It's a bit like when I'm describing externally something you're experiencing internally without you telling me about it. Okay, it stops the world, because a big part of our conditions, if you like, around all this, is that here's this private inside world that nobody can get at, and it's different from the world outside here. And when in this work, what happens is we discover that isn't really how it is. It is like one large circulatory system, like the universe is one big blood system where things flow in and out. Sometimes they seem to be happening inside, sometimes they seem to be happening outside. You know, we sit here working with Sulis Minerva, we're also somewhere working with Athena in Greece and Greek politics. And we've hardly referred to Greek politics, but that's somewhere with us. That's part of the circulatory system. You know, when we touch Romana British temples, we touch the nature of oppression and patriarchy. You know, that's part of what comes into the room. We touch the fact that women can't be hound judges in certain sections of the hound world. Part of it, when none of this is separate. I think so, yeah. I think so. You know, I trust that by working on opposites together, just as we have done these 2 days, has an effect upon the world. Because I believe the world is connected. So somewhere, you know, I don't want to be too literal about it, because you can spin off of these things, but I do actually feel by working on this here, we have some effect upon the situation in Greece. Not a very direct effect, but we have some effect. I think we can't know, right? Think of these things are mysterious. Yeah. It's a mystery, right? So actually, but I think what synchronicities show us, all the synchronicities, and there's lots of them when you really start paying attention, is that this work is not purely internal. So if we stand up from here and there's a van outside with an owl and a hare outside, which I have never seen before. It's not like it's somewhere that, you know, it's not like somebody, I know that somebody's got that van there. It's actually really specific. So that if we let in the spookiness of synchronicity, what it says to us is that there's a connection between inside and outside. And that's the thing that's really spooky, right? Because we get, particularly, you know, we're used to doing inner work together. The idea that it has external effect is genuinely spooky and a bit scary. Yeah. Right, and it's easy, and even now when I said I'm saying this, I'm thinking that sounds really new agey and a bit flaky, and because there's a part of me that can't quite take that on board, although I do somewhat believe, I do kind of believe in it as well.
That's what makes it dangerous.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
At a really small level, I had an experience some time ago where I was in a model with some woman, and it all went terribly wrong, and I felt incredibly guilty, and I just couldn't say anything anyway. Life went on, she lived over the hill, and I thought, I could see the garden and sort of see where she lived. I thought, I don't have to move out, I can't bear this. Anyway, I spent 2 years, on and off, not all the time, doing Tolman practice and sending her loving kindness. I didn't see her during that time, and then I was in Chippenham. Anyway, not been to Chippenham, not to Kim, really. But I was walking up the road, and there she was, and I thought, here we go. And I went, hello. And she went, oh, hello. We had this incredibly good contact. And she hadn't known at all that I was doing this practice.
Yeah, exactly.
I felt so wretched about what I'd done to you, but you didn't notice that. But somewhere something had changed.
Had changed, that's right.
And James Baraz told a story that I thought was actually wonderful. He's a meditation teacher from California. And he said he sent loving kindness in a neutral, easy path, the neutral and the different.
Mm-hmm.
He did his neighbour, he didn't know. And after 6 months or whatever it was, he met up with his neighbour more quickly. The whole relationship had developed and developed.
Well, the thing is, if we start to look at all that, we start to look at the sin. We don't know, we see, what would be happening if we were not sending Sivya good thoughts. It is a genuine kind of mystery. I mean, obviously, I've spent a lot of my life working in a place where everything seems to get worse. I mean, Israel. You know, so I've been going there, 15 years now. And so I'm used to sitting with an intractable situation, and certainly there are lots of times when I think, well, why do I bother, and is there any point? And there's something about trying to trust. And it's the same thing when you work with intractable things internally. Okay, the often nothing does seem to change, and yet I know, just because I'm old, that you could work and work at something and think you're getting nowhere, and nothing looks like it changes, and then one day it's gone, and you don't even notice it going very often. Yeah, and I think that's true of a big difficult external things as well. Things do change. And you can't predict it until it's happened. Once it's happened, everybody says they know why it happened. Look, you know, think of South Africa, everybody says Mandela, right? And of course Mandela was enormous in that. And of course it wasn't just Mandela. It's ridiculous to say Mandela. Mandela was a brilliant leader. But many things contributed to South Africa not becoming a total bloodbath. Healing of the troubles in Ireland, still not perfect by any means, but that again was something that shifted.
Berlin Wall coming
down. Things happen in the world that you can't predict until, because you don't see the underneath work and the invisible work, which is what we're looking at in all kinds of different ways. I read the other day of an extraordinary new educational development that's going on in the third world, and it's come about by a guy called Sujata Mitra, who's IT bloke in New Delhi who his office was just next to a really horrible slum area. And in New Delhi's slum areas are vile, are really beyond anything we can imagine here. And he and the tech IT industry in India is very lucrative. So there's this bizarre thing for him with this beautiful offices next to this terrible thing. And he had an insight one day, the feeling. He put a computer, a laptop computer, in a sort of a nook in between his office and the slum. And he told some of the kids that there's a computer there and they can, you know, it's turned on and they can work with it if they want to. And then he just went away and kind of observed from a distance, but didn't try and teach them, didn't try and, you know, do any do-gooding about it. He just left them with the computer and very shortly they worked out how to use it and they were starting to use it and connecting to the internet and doing all kinds of stuff. So then he decided to push it a bit more and he loaded up a computer with lots of information about molecular biology. And he told the kids that, so he did this, put it back there and told the kids, there's all this interesting stuff about molecular biology. So, you know, let me see if you can understand it. And he sort of checked in on them occasionally, but more or less left them alone. And by the end of the first month, he then asked them a whole series of questions. These are little slum kids, right? About molecular biology. They were able to answer one question correctly in four, having had no teaching, just a computer with loads of information. So then he pushes it a bit further and he gives them some hints and ideas about how to do it. And then shortly, they're within a very short space of time, they understanding the kind of level of molecular biology that you find in university graduates. And then he starts to get into this and he starts to develop and he gets a grant from the people who do the TED Talks, I can't remember what they call it, anyway, they're interested in new developments. He gets a grant and then he sets up offices in India and Mexico and Britain, where he sets up these classrooms that have computers in them. They have somebody in there whose job is to look after the kids to make sure they don't hurt themselves and to make sure they get fed while they're there. And the kids help each other to use the computers and to learn things. And it's nobody interferes with them, nobody tells them what to do. They've got these screens where they have they call them granny screens where retired teachers can pop up and can give the kids advice if they want them. Although the kids can turn the grannies off whenever they want to. And basically, nobody tells the kids what to do, but they're kept safe and contained. And it's been going about 10 years now, and it's having extraordinary kind of results. In that these kids are learning at a much more accelerated rate. It's got the potential to become to be some really big movement in the world, but it comes out to a very simple thing like this man putting a computer in a nook in between a slum and his office, and just following, and the way he describes it, he just follows it every step of the way. He comes back into the mystery, and then he trusts, you know, it's quite interesting in putting the computer out there. The really bizarre thing that he decides to do, given what the kids he's talking about, he loads it up with molecular biology.
Yeah.
The hell would you choose to do that? But he feels that's right somehow. There's something about that, you know. So it's coming from that mischievous kind of place, you know. And of course, it just absolutely inspired that, because the idea that little slum kids can understand molecular biology blows everybody's mind, you know, whenever you hear about that. What? How can even that be? I don't understand molecular biology. How can they do? That's that constancy of love underneath everything, working to heal, working to generate new possibilities, working to create things that we cannot even imagine. And in a way, that's why this work on working with a deep imagination and trusting intuition and trusting the kind of thing that comes out of that place is absolutely central. Well, it changes the world, it changes our relationship to ourselves, to others, changes the whole fabric of the world. And in the end, it's not complex, it's simple. It's as simple as paying attention, letting yourself drop down, letting yourself not know, and then trust the next movement. And then trust the next movement. Trust the forms that arise. It's an act of radical befriending. So you befriend whatever arises. You get interested in it. You be with it more intimately. So it's also about intimacy. You become intimate with the world, intimate with yourself, intimate with everything that you touch. And in return, you're intimately touched back. So just as we end, it's that place where you, when we come into the temple and we ask for the teacher, and we find the impossibility of finding the teacher, and stay in that place and just go back to that place and go back to that place, something changes. Because underneath everything, there is an intention of love working to penetrate the lost and lonely places, to help us all come home. I suppose as we sit here at the end of the third year of all this stuff, really, this is the heart. What we've looked at this weekend is the heart. We've obviously looked at all kinds of stuff, and we will again. But this is the heart place. So there we are. Thank you. No, it's been a very interesting weekend, really, that you can really see, you know, and that we can do this because of just so much work you guys have done. We're able to just go right to the heart of the matter this weekend. And so we'll look at what happens next year. I'll send out some possible dates, and by email we'll work out when we... What's a good time of year to go to the borders? Just to meet
everybody. At the moment, I just need to check when the weddings are, but probably not in the middle of the summer.
No.
So,
are we not having another weekend in the autumn?